and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation.
Faster time goes by, fear is not seen through these eyes. What there was will never be. Now I'm blind and cannot see.
Chad and Mars face evil's mind.
Everybody, I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 570.
Whoa. 70, you say? 570?
570.
What does this mean? This feels significant in some way, shape, or form.
You mean it could be our 400th properly numbered episode together, Chad?
Oh, it's our anniversary? I'm sorry. I forgot to get you something.
Well, by luck of the draw, Dan Jurgens and Ron Mars gave me something.
And what would that be?
The 0 hour 30th anniversary special.
We haven't been at this for 30 years, but sometimes it feels like it.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, man. But 157, right? Or 170? Sorry. Well,
yes, 170. I'm pausing for a second going, what the hell is 157?
I don't know. I'm going to have to look it up now because it's got to mean something. Why did my mind go there?
That was probably just another episode that you tortured Jim and Dan. It's like, oh, God, Chad's back again.
It's possible. It's possible. But yeah, 170, huh?
170, and now we're at 570.
Yeah, that was the first episode after Dan and Jim took off, and then we were breaking, quote unquote, breaking you in, I guess. And it, because you're the toy guy, it made most sense to do two top five merches, right? It was merches. And was it a Larfleeze report
at the same? Probably. That's without going back and looking at the write up. That does sound familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, two top five. George Takei, Lindsay Lohan, and cocaine. What have Chad and Mark done to this show?
Yeah, that at least is a memorable write-up for that episode, if nothing else.
December 11th, 2013. Oh, wow. So 11 years and 400 numbered episodes later, we're still here. And that's worth celebrating.
Arguably.
Our sanity, that remains to be seen. But yes. So now this is something you wanted to do, right? Because the numbers were looking like they were going to line up. So we decided to make a run for this, right?
Yeah. And ultimately, it wasn't much of a final decision between, we can do the 0 hour 30th anniversary special with or without a special guest, depending how things panned out, or we can wrap up War Journal. I would rather have had episode 570 just be 45 minutes of blank air to have that be our special, our anniversary. It's like, no.
Yeah, we had to pick something grandiose, so we didn't want to be too overly negative on any particular anniversary type episode. So obviously we weren't entirely sure. I think it's safe to say we were fairly confident based on solicits, creative teams, so on and so forth, that this was going to be an enjoyable issue, right?
Yes. There's certainly as much as you want to, sometimes you believe in the hype gets you set up for failure, but it seemed like the stars were aligning where there was no reason to think at least wouldn't be entertaining, especially because the two writers involved, at least if there's anybody that's going to give us a decent interpretation of the original Parallax, it would have to be, especially combined between Dan Jurgens and Ryan Mars. It's like, if they couldn't do it, it's like, let's just call it a day.
And the stars aligned even further because DC, you know, helped coordinate, and we were able to get Ron Mars back onto the show.
Yeah, it's been a while.
That's right. So yeah, we reached out to DC and Ron and everybody, and they were all down. But this was a couple of months ago, and obviously, you know, locking things in for a certain, you know, required a little bit of a wait time, but. We checked back in and they said, well, hey, yeah, we're still a go. If you guys want to talk about the 30th anniversary, they were kind enough to give you and I an advance copy of the issue. Obviously, as you guys hear this episode, we're not releasing anything in advance of the issue, but we were able to read it a few days in advance so that we could prepare for our conversation with Ron. And we were able to speak with him. So without further ado, here is that conversation. All right. And on the line now, we have one of the co-writers of the Zero Hour 30th Anniversary Special, a friend of the show, Ron Mars. Welcome to the show.
Welcome back, I think.
I was just thinking that's like, Chad, you blew it. Yes.
Syntax. Come on.
thanks for having me again, guys. Always a pleasure.
For sure. Well, it's nice to have you back on GL.
yeah, you know, I get to come play with the toys now and again. Always fun.
And plus now when it comes to lantern cast appearances, like you're neck and neck with your partner in crime, Daryl Banks. You're getting creeping ever closer.
Well, as long as you know, at some point I can put Daryl in the second place. That's all I require.
All right, well, let's just jump into it, shall we?
Fire away.
All right, so I'm going first. As much as I really want to talk about the ending, it would be a bizarro kind of interview to do that, so I'm going to wait. So let's do the opposite. Let's go in proper order. Let's talk about the beginning. So for Chad and I, and for anybody else out there, could you kind of explain how this whole – obviously, we know it's the 30th anniversary of Zero Hour, but could you explain how this kind of like – how this project came to be, excuse me, when it started coming together, your involvement and the things that like made it possible, other than obviously the direct 30th anniversary.
Mostly it was down to me and Dan Juergens, you know, having a conversation, because Dan and I are friends. And my suspicion was that it was somewhere in January, because I remember it being cold outside when Dan and I just happened to be on the phone, you know, kind of chatting, and ended up talking about the 30th anniversary of Emerald Twilight, 30th anniversary of Zero Hour in the same year, and obviously the Death of Superman and Return of Superman 30th anniversary specials had come out last year, and obviously Dan was involved in both of those, and they sold great, the reception was great, so we ended up kicking around an idea to do something like this, either as a two different specials, one Emerald Twilight and one Zero Hour, or a combined big one with 80 pages. So we ended up getting a green light on the combined aspect. So Dan and I basically split the writing duties. Should anyone care, I'd be interested to figure out who wrote which pages. And just kind of hit the ground running. Once DC gave us a green light back in April, I think, we really had to move, because they wanted the book out in August. And that's a fairly short turnaround for 80 pages.
Now, I don't know about a specific pages that you wrote, but I know I'm pretty sure I can zero in on a specific panel when Kyle said something to Obsidian about, I know your sister, but we won't get into that right now. Was that you?
Yeah, that was me.
Well, speaking of the characters in this, the use of characters like Fatal Five or Invisible Kid, Wave Rider, all really lean towards something we would think Dan Juergens would contribute to the story, while other things are obviously you. In a story like this, where there's so much collaboration from the outset, what actually goes into the character selection to make it like a choice graduate from, you know, it'd be cool if we did, to now they're a critical part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, those are kind of the same thing, really. It's mostly a, hey, how about we put, you know, Starman in the book? And it was mostly just Dan and I kicking a list back and forth on email, of, you know, and, you know, the obvious ones were, without giving too much away, I guess they're on the cover, Kyle, Parallax, Supergirl, Wonder Woman, and Batgirl are kind of the characters who have a bit larger part. And then there's a bunch of characters that we wanted to get in there as well because they were sort of emblematic of the 90s, or at least storylines from that era. Guy Gardner, the aforementioned Starman, a number of other characters who show up, and all serving purposes within the story. We don't, you know, we don't want somebody to show up and stand around in the background just for the sake of being there. We wanted to make sure that once we had figured out our list, that everybody had a role to play in the story. Obsidian shows up and obviously is a bit of a tour guide for us as to what's actually going on in the story. So, you know, it was partially, oh, who makes sense? And it was also partially, well, who, you know, who would we get a kick out of writing and or drawing?
Speaking of Obsidian, Zero Hour is obviously like the first follow-up to Crisis, but it was only until later Crisis-like stories where they started going really further back and just trying to do a one-for-one, whether they were trying to bring in their own version of that story's Flash or their own version of that story's Pariah and so on and so forth. It's interesting, kind of circling back, the Zero Hour didn't have a lot of those apes, basically, of the characters from the original Crisis. But somehow you guys in this made Obsidian in a way the pariah of this story, because he's talking about how I saw this world die. Was that a conscious choice to make him kind of a stand-in pariah?
Not really. I don't think the word pariah ever came up in our discussions. Like, oh, we need somebody to fill that role. It was just a matter of, well, Obsidian's kind of cool, and mm-hmm. he figured in the original Zero Hour, and he, you know, and part of it is just, well, who's, you know, who looks cool? Who's got a cool costume? And Obsidian's got a cool costume, and we could use him in a role that was kind of necessary to get readers up to speed for what's happening within the pages of the story. You know, you never want to do a story, especially one like this, where you're depending on the audience to have already read Emerald Twilight and have already read Zero Hour and be familiar with all of the storylines that sort of play a part in this. That's an unfair ask of the audience, particularly from a story that was originally published 30 years ago. So, you know, you have to find ways to thread that information into the story as naturally as possible, so that new readers don't feel like they're left out and don't really know what's going on, but readers who already have a lot of that information don't feel like the story grinds to a halt and there's just an info dump for four pages.
Yeah, so it's more of a, every story kind of needs someone to tell the background, to give us a bit of an info dump. It's just when it comes to a crisis, we tend to call that person pariah.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a, you know, look, it's a tried and true device. You need, yeah, you need people in your story that do not know what's going on, and you need somebody in the story that does know what's going on so that you can convey that information naturally to the reader. Nothing makes me crazier than when I read a comic or see a movie and, you know, two characters who already know the same information talk to each other about it and explain things to each other. And I'm thinking, you know, this is the worst, clunkiest stuff ever, because people who already know things that each other know don't have this kind of conversation. So you don't want that. You know, I always say that the worst line of dialogue you can write in a comic is, as you all know. If you all know, there ain't no reason to say it.
Very, very true. And besides Obsidian, it's also interesting, and this kind of leads into another question that I had, that it Wave Rider serves a similar purpose, because Wave Rider gives us the important information for how we're here, basically.
And he's sort of the, you know, again, without giving anything away, he's in some ways the denouement at the end of the story, where he plays a large part in how the story figures itself out. And obviously Wave Rider was created by Dan, so yep. It makes complete sense for him to appear within the pages, within the context of the story.
So related to that, and again, by the time this interview comes out, this issue, actually, this won't be released to what, next week. So this issue will already be out by then anyway. So
it'll be a back issue by this time.
Yeah, it probably, sadly, but a good back issue nonetheless. Very good. One of the things I really liked, and it relates to Wave Rider too, is the fact that how this Splinterverse, for lack of a better way of describing it, exists was tied directly to a moment that we remember in Zero Hour, which was that moment when he wanted to return Hal and Kyle into the time stream, but there was a glitch and they disappeared. And of course, we know they ended up going to Oa to fight in Green Lantern Zero. Such a great issue. But now we also know that that was the moment where Parallax created this Splinterverse where he sends this Splinter Parallax off to basically live in the illusion that he had won and he had created his vision and everything. Obviously he did a smaller version though. So my question is, since the Splinterverse Parallax, it's clearly established up until late in the falling apart of his universe as he was running out of power, that he thought there was no other timeline. There was no other universe because he thought he had won. And that's only when he kind of realized that I at least had some understanding of what he was, but he didn't know that to start with. So I guess my question is, what should we assume Parallax Prime, for lack of a better way of describing it, the Parallax that ended up fighting Kyle in Zero Hour and the one we've always followed, how much should we assume that he knew about the Splinterverse? Or was it one of those things where they both basically almost like were mind wiped into forgetting that little diversion ever or that splitting ever happened?
It's almost like we just made stuff up. it's the nature of comics, right? I always tell people, don't think about stuff too hard. Cause ultimately probably none of it makes sense. Right. Bruce Wayne has been like 35 years old for 85 years. I think the story has cohesion and makes sense in and of itself. You can't worry too much about the details of, oh, does this match up with, page 17, panel 4 of issue 3 of Zero Hour? To me, that's sort of losing track of the forest for the trees. We're not going to put the lie to anything directly, but we're also not going to worry about dotting every I and crossing every T in continuity, because that's not what stories are about. Stories are about things happening to characters and characters striving to succeed, to save the universe. And they're about the emotional reactions of those characters. To me, that stuff is much more important than any continuity details that crop up.
No, that makes sense. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on it or if there were if there was like a breadcrumb that was being laid out on purpose in that particular area where somebody might touch upon it or somebody had an idea how to touch upon it.
It's there if you want it, and if you don't want it or don't need it, just ignore it. I think we tried to make this thing as inclusive as possible to readers who, read all this stuff in the 90s and remember it and dug it, as well as people who have never read the initial Zero Hour miniseries in the first place. That's kind of ultimately the job of our job as storytellers, is to make sure that you can go on the ride with this story, whether you're familiar with the background of it or not.
Well, you said the forest for the trees, so let's talk about the forest then a little bit, because looking back, Zero Hour was, it's been 30 years, we can say it. It was an interesting project for DC, because in its efforts to try and, tell a good story, but also address some of the lingering issues still out of Crisis, it also accidentally further complicated some of those things. And at times it even got a bit lost within itself. Some people like to praise the tie-ins more than the main series in some respects. So when you're writing a 30-year anniversary special, how much are you simply trying to recapture the essence of the just the era and the storytelling that was told then versus actually trying to intentionally recapture maybe some of that chaos as well?
I think first and foremost, the job is always to tell a story that you would be excited to read.
Mm-hmm.
I don't come from a school of feeling like comic book stories should be based on and explain other comic book stories. Mm-hmm. I don't really care what happened between, you know, panels 3 and 4 of page 17 of Avengers 52, in 1968. I just don't. I'm not saying that nobody should care. If all of that continuity stuff is your jam, there are writers who do that. There are books that are kind of built around that sort of thing, which is fine. We should have those sorts of kind of inside baseball, very, very comic book continuity oriented stories, as well as stuff that's completely ground floor read. So, you know, when I approach something like this that has a basis in a story 30 years ago, my chief concern is that we are telling a story that is accessible to everybody. And by everybody, I mean, it should be accessible and not boring to people who are intimately familiar with all these details. And it should be accessible to somebody who has no idea about any of it. And sometimes that's not a terribly easy line to walk. Sometimes it's impossible, but you gotta do the best you can because you're trying to tell a story that's going to have that's going to have broad appeal. So at the same time, at the same time, I am trying to tell a story that is going to interest me and that is going to be exciting for me as a reader and as a writer. And you're also trying to make sure that that story can appeal to not just the folks who were, who were tied into this stuff 30 years ago.
Yeah, I guess that was my question obviously you're trying to tell a good story. You've made that very clear, of course, obviously. So you're just writing to tell a good story. But is any part of you going, should I maybe shift my voice to Ron Mars earlier in his career? Because that's the kind of, quote unquote time that this story is taking place, so that I'm sort of homaging myself in some way, with as self-aggrandizing as that sounds.
No, not really. I mean, hopefully I'm a better writer now than I was then. So,
yeah.
So you bring all of your experience and all the tools in your toolbox to bear on what you're doing now while trying to capture a flavor of that era. But I should point out that this story is set in the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
It is set in the current DC universe. That's where it opens. The opening pages that were released as a preview are set in the current DC universe with Kyle out in space. And then the story that takes place, the story that we tell goes to a quote unquote splinterverse, where a lot of the stuff that happened in the 90s sort of branched off and took on a life of its own.
All right, so let's start segueing a little bit, because I do want to get to the end and want to make sure we have time to talk about the end a little bit. One of the things overall, before we get to that, I think one of the things I enjoyed about the issue greatly was the fact that it did feel exactly like a spiritual successor to a certain extent of Zero Hour. It felt like it belonged in that era, the way the book kind of like worked. It felt that, as well as a very good Kyle story. So it really was accomplishing, I think, the things like you and Dan talked about that you wanted to accomplish. And I thought that worked very well. And I also liked the fact that it was a story dealing with Zero Hour era parallax and with the acknowledgement of what we know now about the fear entity, but that didn't dominate the main story, which personally for me, since I'm a big fan of classic Your Parallax, so I thought that was, I really enjoyed that. So we wanted to
make sure that it was sort of true to the Parallax depiction of that era, because it is a celebration of that, of that era and that version.
And I appreciate that. And I think that because as we've gotten with like convergence parallax, sometimes it's real easy to have that opportunity and then, you know, Jagged Teeth, Fear Bug, and which leads us to the end, which I also enjoyed, that after Kyle gets back and he's kind of lamenting not being able to save the other universe or really getting a chance to save it, which I also thought was cool symmetry with Hal, because it's kind of with Hal with Coast City that he never really had a chance to save Coast City, let alone be able to do it, that as he's kind of playing this stuff and how this is like going to haunt me, then you have the narration coming from that asteroid about go, leave, forget the destruction you left behind. Soon you will come to know that you made a mistake that will haunt you. You might think that you put reality in its proper place, but what you've really done is just free me. And we see the parallax entity. So the first question that came to mind when I read this was, which parallax entity are we supposed to take that this is? Is this just the parallax entity that was in the Splinterverse, Hal? Is this parallax put back, like our parallax with that splinter put back together? I was just curious which, if it's intended to be one parallax, which parallax in your, from your perspective, is it?
To be revealed. Okay. I think we put that in there because we needed to address it and acknowledge it, but you know, maybe somewhere down the road, we or somebody else will pick up that piece and run with that. But, you know, one of the things that you want to come out of a crossover story like Zero Hour or even an anniversary special like this is you want to leave some material behind so that there are pieces to pick up and other stories to tell rather than closing off every avenue for the thing to continue.
But I assume you know which way you would take it.
I do, but I'm not okay. Telling you.
Guys. No, I wasn't going to push it.
Or frankly, anybody else. So.
Oh yeah, that was the gist of that. I wasn't going to push the. No, you have to tell him. Put the shine the light on him and make him sweat. No, I just wanted the acknowledgement that you really know in your mind's eye which one it is or where you would go with it, and that's fine with me.
Yeah, and you know, hey, it would be great to be able to tell that story at some point.
Yes, hopefully you and Dan can.
But that's the nature of a shared universe, is you sort of, you know, you leave open-ended questions and answer them anon.
Well, I feel like I know the answer to this, but I think it's interesting to me that Parallax's original kind of idea was that I can fix it. I can make it all better. I can correct all of the wrongs and right everything. And we finally, after 30 years, get to see at least a piece of what that universe would have been like that he would have created. But he allowed Clark to die, the bat to be broken, and the Green Lantern Corps to never have been. What do you feel about that particular glimpse into Parallax's end motives there?
Well, certainly for him, it's, you know, he wants a very controllable reality. He wants he wants the world to be arranged in the way that is most beneficial to him. So anybody that might challenge his reality is not really welcome in it.
Yeah, that's what I figured the answer was, but I thought it was so funny that, you know, there even actually Mark, he's told me a lot in the past about it would always be cool if we actually got to see a story where Parallax got his wish. Like, how would that play out? So I thought it was interesting that this was the type of universe that played out when he did get his wish. So that was cool.
Plus, it raised the idea of something that could have actually been a problem with the main Zero Hour if he had won too. The idea was the amount of energy it takes not just to create this thing but to maintain it. What happens if it starts, your power starts ebbing and waning, and what are you going to do to maintain it all? Can you possibly keep that all together? So
yeah, that's true. Well, we coming up a little bit on time, so I wanted to ask one last question. We have speaking of the return of an event like Zero Hour, we kind of have an homage that we get a veritable who's who of this era of artists in Daryl Banks, Kelly Jones, Tom Grummet, Norm Rapmund, Jerry Ordway, Paul Pelletier, Howard Porter, and Dan Jurgens, and Brett Breeding. What was it like working with all of these people again?
You know, it was just an absolute pleasure. It was, it was, you know, the cliche is, well, let's get the band back together and put on another show. That's really what it amounted to. Although for some of the guys, like I think maybe Tom Grennan and I had done a few pages together, but I had never worked with Kelly Jones. So this was an opportunity to do that. And, you know, like reconnecting with Daryl Banks and Paul Pelletier, who I had done so many Green Lantern issues with, was just great. It's, you know, you fall right back into the same rhythm that you had over the years. And, you know, it's a pleasure to, as a writer, it's a pleasure to work with artists who know that you know what they're going to bring to the table, and they you know that they're going to make you look good. They're going to take your pages and bring something out of them that you maybe hadn't even thought of. And that's just that's the best part of the job, is when you start getting the artwork back from the script that you wrote and seeing the stuff that was in your head brought to life. It's the irreplaceable part of the process.
Does it all, technically speaking, does it all kind of flash back to the way the comic book making process used to be for you guys? Like, obviously the apparatus has changed, but is there like a different sort of rhythm that you all flash back to the way the comics used to be made at that time?
Not really. I mean, it's, you know, it's words and pictures. The tools to make them might change along the way, but the process is kind of the same. You know, the process is the same since it's been, since comics have been a thing, in terms of how the writer and the artist, or the cartoonist, if it's the same person, brings that story to life on the page. Yeah, I don't think that there's a huge difference. That, like I said, the tools have changed. Things are, you know, things are digital now to a great extent. Although Paul Pelletier still works on paper. I think Tom Grummet still works on paper. Dan Jurgens as well. So there's an old school method to some of it, but it's also a you know, the journey by which you get to your destination doesn't really matter. The destination, the finished product that's in your hands, most of the readers do not know which pages were done digitally, which pages were done analog, how the whole, you know, how the whole thing shakes out.
For sure. Well, it was a pleasure to read, and it was a lot of fun. I can only hope that one day we get a collector's edition sort of Zero-Hour story where this is fit tightly in there, and somebody finally adds the epilogue to Zero-Hour, that is Green Lantern Zero, into one of these trade paperbacks. But, you know, from my lips to DC's editorial team.
I think it might have been included in like a hardcover or something like that. I know at some point it did get into a Zero-Hour edition. Maybe it was the Omnibus, I'm not sure.
Omnibus, it would be a given. It's such an important part of the story, and it's not, I know it's a 16-year-old Green Lantern podcast, we're obviously biased, but come on.
Plus the issue,
that was a fun story to write, and it, you know, was a nice follow-up to everything that had happened in the miniseries. And it was, you know, it was great for me to be able to write a Kyle Howe story so quickly on the heels of Emerald Twilight.
For sure.
Yeah, it was such a good issue. That's what makes it even more, makes it more of a sin with a checkbox on it that it's not included. But yes, it overall, I think I was really looking forward to this anniversary issue. And I think everyone involved, but especially you and Dan, I think you really did a good job, because as far as I'm concerned, you were the only two writers who really get the Hal Jordan parallax. Obviously, makes perfect sense you would, since you really you created him, that version of Hal. But I think Dan Jurgens is the only other writer who I really enjoy his take, because it's similar, and it's like he gets the core of that it's still Hal. He's just pushed over the edge, and he's seeing things like his name from a different point of view. But I really enjoyed this issue, and I think it does fall it is a nice homage and a nice companion piece to both, like you mentioned, the introduction of Kyle, Emerald Twilight, and Zero Hour proper. So I think you guys did very good job on this.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you coming along for the ride. We had a ball.
Of course. And before we let you go, is there anything else you got coming up in the pipeline you'd like to talk about and point readers towards?
In fact, the same day that Zero Hour special comes out, got a story in Savage Sword of Conan number 4, which is an El Borak story with Mike Perkins, who is a buddy and an amazing artist. And some other stuff coming up that hasn't been announced yet. But there's always something on my desk, so it's much better than working for a living.
Such as it is. Well, thanks for so much for coming on the show, Ron. We really appreciate it. Always happy to have you. And maybe we'll do it again in the next few years. Maybe there'll be a 35th anniversary.
Sounds good, guys. You know where to find me.
All right.
Yeah, we have a great night. Ron.
All right. See you guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. So that was our latest interview with Ron Mars. Ron's always fun to have on the show, and we always appreciate Ron's insights. And like he said, at least he's happy he's creeping up on Daryl as far as being like the biggest, probably the biggest guest or friend to the show, other than maybe you and I. I guess we have to, because since you and I both started as guests, and now we're guests that won't leave, Chad.
Yeah.
A couch that's always occupied.
Freeloaders over here. That's what we are.
Yeah. And one of the people responsible for that freeloading to start is joining us now for the review. and that, of course, is Dan, not Jurgens, but Kurtzky.
Get off my couch.
I'm blaming it on Jim.
God, I have to burn this thing.
So, welcome to the show, Dan.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, how could I miss that? Listen. I had to complete the Lantern Cast Zero Hour trilogy, and I look forward to several years in the future when we do another podcast episode reviewing Zero Hour for some reason.
The 40th anniversary special.
But yeah, the 30th anniversary special issue proper is now out for the masses to be read and consumed by, so it's now time for us to have our spoiler-filled discussion about the special. I was going to say the issue, but the special number one issue that we have here today.
The special issue.
That's right.
Go for it, Dan.
All right, so Zero Hour 30th Anniversary Special, written by Dan Jurgens and Ron Mars, with art by Daryl Banks, Kelly Jones, Tom Grummett, Norm Rapperman, Jerry Ordway, Paul Pelletier, Howard Porter, Dan Jurgens, Brett Breeding, and Alex and Claire on colors, and Troy Petrie on letters. Took a village to raise this book. All right, so Green Lantern Kyle Rayner responds to a distress call from an alien world where a strange portal suddenly appeared. To Kyle's surprise, Wally West, the Flash, is reaching out through the portal, talking about the end of the world. Kyle falls through the portal and ends up in Gotham City, where he and Wally are immediately attacked by members of the Fatal Five, enemies of the Legion of Superheroes. Flash dies in the battle, and Kyle goes off to find answers. This leads to run-ins with Barbara Gordon Batgirl, Supergirl, The Ray, and even Azrael, before Donna Troy shows up and uses her lasso of truth to get to the bottom of what's going on. Kyle has fallen into some sort of alternate universe or timeline where the darkest events of the 1990s, like the death of Superman and the breaking of Batman's back, were permanent changes, and now it seems that the reality itself is beginning to collapse. Parallax shows up, insisting that he can fix everything if he can just get his hands on Kyle's ring, and the heroes are divided on what to do. Some trust Kyle, while others are willing to do anything to save their reality. The Fatal Five show up to back up Parallax, and even more heroes join the chaos, namely Obsidian, Connor Hawk Green Arrow, Guy Gardner in his red armor, and Jack Knight Starman. The fighting continues until Parallax finally takes Kyle's ring, which magically makes himself a million times more powerful for some reason, his words, not mine, and he sends the entropic forces eating away at reality back through the portal to Kyle's world, the main DC universe. Kyle immediately starts talking about how saving his universe is more important because it's bigger and more people live there. Then he suddenly and abruptly shifts gears and wants nothing more than to find a way to save both universes. But then Wave Rider shows up to explain why that's impossible. Apparently, when the heroes rebooted the universe at the end of the original Zero Hour event, they didn't do it quite right. And a piece of parallax split off and found its way into this small shard of reality, where it proceeded to enact Hal's original zero-hour plan on a much smaller scale. But now that this aspect of parallax was nearly out of power, the reality he made could no longer sustain itself and was collapsing. Wave Rider takes Hal home as that reality and everyone in it fades away out of existence. Kyle is unhappy about everything that's happened, but little does he know that the Parallax entity has been set free, presumably from the universe that just ended? I don't know. The end.
Yeah, so let's deal with the end first, only because I couldn't really do that in the interview with Ron as much as I wanted to. I had to wait. Yeah, I think when I first read this, when I first read it, I thought there were only two options. It's either our entity finally, we haven't seen in friggin' forever, for some reason being called to action because of this, or it was the parallax, the shard of the parallax entity that was in the Splinterverse that he basically caught a ride, which in Kyle's ring, and came back to our universe, which would make sense that he would kind of get out of Dodge there. But I actually think it may very well be a combination of the two, that the reason why Parallax might be quote-unquote free is because arguably this could be the first time Parallax, the entity, has ever been 100% whole in the entire time that we've known him, since unbeknownst to us, a fraction was in another universe, and now that fraction has been returned, and he's completely free and completely whole. But I think it's one of those three, no matter how you slice it. I can't imagine there's any other realistic possibility. It's either ours, it's either just that the Splinterverses, or they've combined back into one whole entity.
The only thing that makes sense to me, just within the confines of this issue, is the idea that the Splinter entity followed Kyle back through the portal, which... I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem to make visual sense because he just comes out of a rock or something. And like, they could have done a thing where, like, because Kyle is wearing like Donna's necklace or something as he comes through. Like, they could have done some kind of thing where, like, oh, something hitched a ride that way. But it was very kind of awkward and confusing. But I believe what they were going for is the Parallax entity. The aspect of it that was in that pocket reality is now here, which, you know, you must have been seeing red the entire time you read this, Mark, because this one shot over and over and over again wholly rejects the notion of a pre-retcon parallax even existing.
I don't know. I mean, I know where you're going with it, but again, and despite the fact that Chad never wanted me to go down this road in the interview, I knew Ron would say something if I went down that road, Chad, about the fact that I acknowledge the fact. It's like, I'm glad they acknowledged that the fear entity was there. It's like the elephant in the room, but it didn't factor into the main bulk of the story as far as what he was doing. That we didn't get the convergence crap when it was like, okay, three panels of regular looking zero hour parallax, and here come the jagged teeth and the entities popping out and all this stuff. I do think that. So I think they walked that line. And as Ron said, he and Dan made a conscious effort to write parallax kind of the way he was back then, that's how they wanted to portray him. When you talk about the entity at the end, I think there's no doubt that at the very least, there's a part. If we're not looking at simply the entity that came out of the Splinterverse, Hal, there's no doubt that entity came, that fraction came back. Like I said, if it's not just that entity we're looking at, that he's merged back into the original entity and they're back to. And I would find it hard to But in a way, think about it. If it's just a Splinterverse parallax, now we're talking, we literally have three different parallax entities in our universe now. We have ours, or we haven't seen him forever. We would have this one. And then we have still have technically the Convergence parallax, unless that's part of their plan to bring like all these entities together. One of the things related to that I found interesting is, once again, since you don't see, when you don't see bodies, it doesn't mean they're dead. And plus, it's in comic books. Even if you do see bodies, it doesn't mean that they're dead. We never actually see that universe completely collapse. So there's a chance that at least Parallax could survive, the HAL Parallax, which would be really intriguing, because if it's true, probably like we all think, that at least the entity got the hell out of Dodge. And to me, it makes more sense that he got out of the ring, in the ring. Because don't forget, HAL had the ring on his finger. Yeah, HAL had Kyle's ring on his finger. So it makes much more sense for him to, for Parallax to go out of HAL into the ring. That we could actually have an opportunity, think about it, without avoiding a retcon, we could actually have a Parallax HAL Jordan that no longer has the fear entity in him at all. If he survived, if this Parallax survived that universe. So that would be cool. But I wish we had gotten more of Parallax in this issue. And I think he was mostly written the way we would expect him to be written. And you have an excuse if he's not 100% anyway, because we know he's a fraction. He's a fragment. I just didn't like there was that one part when he's calling people idiots and morons, because that's Convergence Parallax, which I never quite got. That's not crap HAL was doing back in the day. That's like his IQ dropping 20 points. That was not the way it was, but that's the way Convergence Parallax was written. But I don't know. I think overall, I liked the story overall. I thought it, the thing that I liked the most about what they did was that they tied this universe existing into something we already knew technically didn't go according to plan back in the original Zero Hour. That moment when Wave Rider's trying to merge HAL and Kyle back into the time stream, when the rebooted universe catches up and he can't. And we know the original explanation was simply because that's when HAL creates the vortex to take him back to Oa and Kyle goes with him. Now we know at the same point, Parallax being defeated, this is his last Hail Mary, that he creates a Splinterverse and he hides it. And so I kind of like that moment now is almost like been Jeff-conned into having two different reasons why, that's the reason why Wave Rider could merge everybody back into the time stream.
Now, as far as Dan, your your assumption that Mark would have been mad that they started doing the fear bug references and stuff like that, I didn't tell Mark this, but I, in my building of the questions I was going to ask Ron, one of them that I ended up scrubbing, just because, one, we know Ron pretty well, we know how he likes to answer things, and two, I just assumed we also know him well enough to know what he won't answer. And this fell in line with either A, we're going to get a standard kind of non-answer type of thing, or he can't answer it for whatever reason. I was going to ask if DC had a mandate that it still had to tie somehow into the fear entity. Like, we couldn't, there had to be a reference or something out there that sets up something involving or referencing or acknowledging the fear entity. Because I think it's unfair for us to, and I'm not saying we are, I think it's unfair of us to assume that Dan or Ron like heavily dislike that or wouldn't want to do that themselves or anything. Cause though we have to leave that as a possibility, I suppose, but something in me thinks that DC wanted it to end in such a way or a heavy reference to the fear entity, which makes me appreciate what we get in this story all the more, because as in our interview with Ron, in our conversation with him, he, as Mark, you just alluded to, he made it very clear that like they wanted to write Parallax as much as they could in Zero Hour. And I think the way Ron phrased that answer, and again, I could just be reading in between every little word he said, which I am apt to do. I think he was telling us basically that I tried to give Parallax fans as much Parallax as I could before I had to do what DC wants me to do. Again, that's a reading a lot between the lines with a lot of assumptions in between, but I think they had to do something with the fear bug stuff. So I do enjoy this. Now, before I get into all the different things I do like about the story and everything else, I do want to give you an opportunity, Dan, to tell us why you don't like it. And I'm not being like, okay, so we can prove you wrong. It's just Mark and I both, it's rare that we both like something. So I'm very curious what you don't like about it.
Yeah, I mean, at first I was a little annoyed at how there's a lot of talking in circles in this story, and nobody can ever make progress because somebody decides to just keep punching somebody else, and until like something else happens that's bigger than them to shake them out of it. But like, whatever. So that's the classic superheroes misunderstand each other and fight when they first meet kind of thing. That's whatever. The thing that really kind of killed this whole thing for me was what an incredibly hopeless story it is overall. And like the real tipping point for me was when the main DC universe suddenly was put in danger, Kyle immediately he turned this into the trolley problem. He basically just, without even hesitating, started talking about how, well, if we're going to save one universe, it should be the bigger one with more people in it, I guess. I mean, if you really look at the numbers, everybody, and then I think somebody, maybe even Donna, was like, well, no, wait a minute, that kind of makes sense. I'm like, really? This is the conversation we're having, and it's going on for a couple pages? And then
it was the multiverse too. They were that there was a hint that this could spread beyond just one universe.
I know. And like from a pragmatic third person vantage point, it does make sense. But at the same time, I don't think it makes sense for something Kyle Rayner would think. And it also made it feel like really disingenuous, like when he all of a sudden flipped completely to the opposite to say, but you know what, we can find a way to save everything. I'm like, then why did you bring up this shit like a page and a half ago? What are you talking? First, you're talking about measuring the value of this many human lives versus that many human lives, and now suddenly all that's out the window. And then as soon as Kyle becomes the voice of like, hey, we can do anything, Wave Rider shows up and says, actually, no, you can't. Everybody's going to die now. And then they do, and the story's over. So, like, it was a very, I don't know. Like, I don't need every story to have a happy ending. I don't need every story to prove the all-consuming power of hope and go-get-it-ness or whatever. But it just felt kind of, I don't know, I wasn't prepared for this wave of nihilism to come off the page and hit me in the face, you know? Like, but actually, if nothing matters, it's all going to die anyway. You can go home, though.
But objectively speaking, going into this issue, was there really any other way for the story to go? Because you, other than having a hint for setting up a sequel, which they did, and technically, like I said, you could look at this as there's multiple ways to go. Obviously, they directly are setting up something to do with the Parallax entity, which would be cool if they actually get a chance to follow up on it. But like I said, you don't see the other universe completely collapse. Parallax is still not, he's still Parallax. You know, if nothing else, you would think right when the clock's about to hit zero, why can't he just stop time and then leave that universe and try to get enough power to save it and come back? But it almost had to end in a negative way because, I mean, based on this universe we were going to discover, you knew it was very unlikely this universe was going to continue to exist, especially because Parallax was in charge of it. So,
well, like, I don't know what you guys knew before this, but like, I went into it not having any real idea how this was going to exist at all. So, I mean, talk about a million different ways it could end. Like, we have a multiverse. This could just be part of it, you know? Like, there's, you could defeat Parallax and leave that world to its own devices, or you could reboot it like you did in the regular Zero Hour. Like, I don't know. Like, but like, I'm not at all confident that there were any survivors other than who hitched a ride through that Wave Rider portal, just because like the last shot we see of that reality is like Hal Parallax and a couple other people as like their bodies are disintegrating along with like the last chunk of city that exists. Like until something comes around to tell me otherwise, like I think that all of that is gone. And I don't know. It doesn't feel like it had to be. It feels like this was like kind of funneled in a Doom centric direction. And I don't know. It doesn't sit right with me.
Because this is a Splinter universe, does this mean it's like a fragment of Hypertime or something? Like if we were to explain it in terms of the multiverse and the map of the multiverse, is this a splinter of Hypertime that we're talking about? Because they clearly have, it's not just like a localized version of Earth, because they have their own future, they have their own legion. Having your own legion means having a bunch of alien species. Kara exists, like so on. So like a universe exists here. So is this a splinter time? What I don't understand.
You know, you might have actually just fixed it, Chad, because the way Hypertime works is like oh, it's a short term potential timelines that exist for a little while and then stop.
Yeah.
But we've seen people, including Jon Stewart in his current form, pluck those out and make them real, you know? So like, yeah, there is a way for it to come back right there. Hypertime.
Yeah. So
I don't think it's Hypertime though.
See, all of this is moot because we could ask Ron, but he's just said he would just tell us, you know, I'm just telling a good story. There wasn't a whole lot of thought into exactly what kind of timeline this is. This is just the kind of stuff that we as the continuity experts, quote unquote experts, and so on and so forth, come up with when we read these stories. But it could be a Hypertime thing. It could just be like, you know, Parallax only, the Splinter Parallax only had enough to mold a piece of Hypertime to his whims. And because Hypertime always will come to its own natural ending, perhaps, you know, Parallax's abilities to mold it to what he wanted it to be also enabled it to live a bit longer than it really ever would have. And Kyle just got sucked into its natural death.
I will say, well, first, I want to correct myself from a few minutes ago. Jon Stewart did not mold Hypertime or whatever. The mad god Isek did. Mm-hmm. And Jon is just exploring the newly solidified Hyper timelines. But what I will say is that even if Hypertime had nothing to do with how this existed in the first place, Hypertime could still be the explanation for how it could be revisited later.
Yeah, true.
I would agree with that. But yeah, I don't think it's Hypertime. I think it's just because, again, this whole universe was hidden, that, you know, basically until it started falling apart, probably that's, I think, how Wave Rider found it. And that's the only way Hal, this version of Hal, even was able to realize it, that this wasn't, that he basically hadn't succeeded in Zero Hour. That so I think it's just that this was how Parallax was able to create that, of course, is interesting. But again, we won't know, because who knows if Ron and Dan gave it that much thought either, because, and if they did, you know, like you said, if we had asked them that, he wouldn't have given us probably that much of an explanation of it. But I do think it's, like I said, I like the fact that they tie it into that Wave Rider moment, because now you get a little more meat on the bone. It's like, it's not just that. And because I did ask Ron, like, it's like, well, what do you think? Like, after that moment happened, I mean, obviously the Splinter Parallax has no memory of anything else, of ever not being the only Parallax. So what does our Parallax remember? Were they both like both mind wiped at the same time? It's like, does a Parallax Prime not even remember doing that? Which is probably the case, if I had to guess. We never got an answer to that one either, but I didn't think we would. But Yeah, I don't know. I think they came up with a clever way of it existing. And what, as we speculated before, it wasn't the only way it could have done, could have happened. It could have just been one of the universes in the multiverse in which Hal, if he didn't completely succeed, something similar though. I did float the idea that it was a failsafe that Hal thought he was losing, and they basically plucked something out. So I kind of was on the right track, just not quite going down the right road. But it was in the vicinity. Just made the wrong turn off.
You know, I was thinking right before reading this, I was kind of expecting it to be the same thing that happened at the end of Emerald Knights, where Hal Jordan the end of Zero Hour time traveled somewhere else, had an adventure, and then eventually went back to finish doing original Zero Hour. Like, maybe this was... Because, like you ever want to bring back the original version of Parallax, there's, like, a good chunk of time there where he's just darting back and forth through the time stream before he's revealed in the second-to-last issue of Zero Hour. So he can pop up wherever and whenever you need him to.
That is actually true, yes. But without any need for a retcon, yes, because basically this is him... doing what he was doing in Zero Hour. He's just finally caught up to us, basically. We've caught up to him, if you will.
Dan, you still have your recap in front of you. What did you say about how they restarted the universe? What, in the original Zero Hour?
He said he made a mistake. Or there was a mistake.
Yeah,
that, which really wasn't, well...
No, that's why I wanted him to reread it.
The way I phrased it was... when the heroes rebooted the universe at the end of the original Zero Hour event, they didn't do it quite right, and a piece of Parallax split off and found its way into a small shard of reality, proceeded to enact Hal's original Zero Hour plan on a much smaller scale. Yeah.
So they didn't do it right, meaning, no shit, they didn't do it right, when this haphazard plan they had to use the Ray, Superman's heat vision, Captain Atom's blast and Donna Troy's Dark Star funneled through Wave Rider into damage to spark a big bang. There wasn't a lot of thought that went into let's make a really big explosion.
you know what he meant, Chad. But all kidding aside, technically speaking, it's not so much that the rebooting of the unit that there was a hitch in their giddy up when they were trying to do that. In all honesty, the problem, the glitch had nothing to do with Wave Rider or anybody else. The glitch had to do with Parallax. Parallax was the glitch. There's just more of a glitch than we thought. We thought originally we were just led to believe that the reason. Now, you didn't know it in reading the proper miniseries. You only read it by getting the Green Lantern Zero. But the reason why he lost Hal and Kyle when he wanted to merge them back in was because Hal used his power and took himself back to Oa. Now we know that's also the moment when Parallax, before he sent himself back to Oa, sent that splinter version of himself off into a pocket universe. So it was less they rebooted it wrong. It's just the fact that Wave Rider is not as omnipotent as he thinks that he is.
Which is a common theme for Wave Rider. I think it's also interesting, too, when we're talking about putting this thing in a timeline. Isn't there a narrative bubble towards the beginning of this that tells us where this story actually takes place in terms of current continuity?
Yes. This story takes place before issue number 8 of the Jeremy Adams run of Green Lantern, which is the issue with the Kyle Rayner backup story.
Where he's sitting there having coffee on an asteroid, right?
Yeah, where he's kind of questioning, like, man, what am I even doing out here? Like, yeah. I didn't have the time to do it before this, but I'm interested to kind of reread that.
Don't.
Just with this in my mind, just to see, like, hey, does this make
sense? There's nothing.
No?
Because he has that conversation. It'd be one thing if he was having a conversation with a construct Donna, but he's having a conversation with Alex, remember?
Yeah.
So, and he's not holding this little... Donna Troy Wonder Woman talisman around his neck or anything like that. Like there's nothing there. Which like, don't get me wrong. Like, I don't think that's the point that backup story was always intended to be referencing this. It's just like, in terms of fitting it in, where does it fit in here? So I don't expect to get a whole lot of meat out of that connection, but yeah.
I'm actually kind of surprised that this takes place in the present day. Like, the only, like, really the only reason I can see for it needing to is the idea that maybe this version of the Parallax entity is going to go forward into something else, but.
Well, yeah, I suppose that is a part, that is a partial reason. Plus, it probably has more weight that way. They wanted to have it have more weight. So, and no, again, so if it basically, it's almost like dumb luck of the draw that Kyle gets pulled into this. So that's the, in a way that's kind of, you can make a case that that could have been a stronger reason. I mean, you can make it, but other than, I don't know. I think that could be weak. I mean, because there's no particular reason why, you know, Kyle just happened to be in the right place / wrong place at the wrong time for that.
Yes,
for
that story of his life.
Oh yeah. I mean, but they make it clear, even if you didn't know which issue, the fact that he's talking about that he can't, that he's cut off from Earth, he can't access Earth. And plus, you know, like Ron made it pretty clear when we were talking that, you know, that it, that story absolutely is taking place, you know, and that was, I guess, the plan to have it take place in current continuity, which, again, you can kind of see because Kyle has a little more bravado, which is kind of anti-Kyle on a certain level. But he has a lot of confidence in this issue, which would kind of indicate that it's certainly not the Kyle from like 10 years ago. Now, maybe a little false bravado too, with like with Parallax. I've stopped you before. It's like, well, you really didn't. You blew up Oa. You were able to do that, but pretty much you've lost every time you fought Parallax. So that's kind of, but still, yeah. I respected that though. I did respect that.
Yeah, no, it's nice to see Kyle being confident. Although he seems to have lost some street smarts. I couldn't believe it took him like 30 pages to realize he wasn't on his Earth. Like, no matter how many alternate versions of people he talked to and how, like, weirdly different the Flash's costume was, or the giant memorial statue for Batman he landed in front of, he's like, you know, something seems weird around here. I don't know. I guess I'll go over here. Like, it takes him until he sees that Superman was still dead from Doomsday. And then he's like, wait a second, I might not be home after all.
One thing I wanted to pick up or touch upon, because this I've been thinking about this since we did the interview, Chaz. That, not that it's been that long, but it's me, so it doesn't take long for me to do a post game. When you asked Ron the question about the things basically that were in this universe or not in this universe, and what does that say about, you know, Parallax's stratagem, or what if he had won in 0 hour, what things would have looked like? And, you know,
the question was, Parallax is like, I can fix everything, I can do everything. It's interesting that the world that we find him in, where he fixed everything, Clark is dead, the Bat is still broken, and the Green Lantern Corps never was.
Ooh, good question.
So, you know, the basic answer was, well, because Hal wouldn't want anybody to make waves, pretty much. He doesn't want anybody who can throw a monkey wrench into his idea of what order is. And I think there's the majority of it, a large percentage of it. But I also think we can't forget about the fact that it's almost like looking at the difference between Infinity War Thanos and Endgame Thanos. Because 0 hour Parallax in the beginning was a little more, I hate to say naive, but a little more optimistic that he could create everything perfectly. And maybe, you know, remember, he even talked about, hey, I could even bring the Guardians back, all this stuff. But this universe was created, this Parallax was created at the moment of his defeat. So he knows, even if he doesn't know why, he probably has more of a motive to make sure that the most logical opponents to him, a built-in resistance, shouldn't be there now that you're having a second crack at this. So I think that can't be completely dismissed either. Just like Thanos realized, thanks to the events of Endgame, it's like, oh, if I leave half the universe still alive that remembers everything the way it was, then people are not going to be happy. People are not going to accept it, and there's going to be a certain percentage of people that are always trying to undo what they did. But if they don't remember it, then that's never going to be the case. So I think there's a certain, I think that analogy works here too. I think that is also why Parallax created the universe the way he did and what's missing from it. So
that's funny. I don't usually think about 0 hour Parallax as through the lens of the typical Hal Jordan bluster. But you're right, like he really is like so super sure that he can absolutely do this crazy thing that he's never tried before or seen done before, but I'm sure it'll work out.
And plus, it also, as I think I mentioned in the interview, it also gives you a little glimpse of maybe on a much bigger scale. If Hal had been successful in Zero Hour, that recreating the entire this massive universe, he may have ended up in the same spot anyway, because he may have had the power to create it, but maybe he didn't. Maybe it needed a certain amount of power to maintain it, and now he didn't have it. So it could have. So maybe it was. It is almost like it. Not so much in a hyper time way, but maybe it was a glimpse that this could have happened if Hal had been successful. Now, maybe he wouldn't have been. It wouldn't have happened if he had been successful without resistance, if he hadn't, or if he had succeeded in creating enough things first. Because, hey, if he had created quickly enough, maybe he could have just recharged. So it's interesting. But I did think of that, too. It's the idea that, well, this is. That was a whole lot of power he needed to do what he did, which shows you how powerful he was. But it's like, but he still didn't get the entire universe created before things started hitting the fan. So that is what other things that maybe the Splinterverse Parallax was subconsciously, without even realizing, that his marching orders were a little different for multiple reasons.
Speaking of his motives and stuff, I'm curious, because when Wally first shows up. It's all collapsing. There won't be anything left soon. They're trying to stop me because they think I'm doing it, but it's not me. And then we get back, and then I quickly read through everything Batgirl and Supergirl said and everything. So it's not them who thinks anything. And then I read the stuff that the Fatal Five were saying to Parallax, and then they don't really mention it. So who thinks Wally's destroying the universe? Is that... Does Parallax actually think the heroes are doing something, or is that just what he's telling the Fatal Five to keep them in check? Or I guess we won't really know, because the answer is clearly not in the page. So like, I just speculatively, I don't know who thinks Wally's responsible for this. Who is he talking about?
I would assume that he's kind of being scapegoated. That's what I'm going to assume. Because divide and conquer is a pretty effective strategy. What page was that on?
The very first page, well, second page. Wally comes through the portal and says it's all collapsing. They're trying to stop me because they think I'm doing it, but it's not me.
Yeah. So that's what I'm going to assume. I'm going to assume if anything, Parallax probably is pointing the fingers at. Remember, because he does the same thing when he finally arrives. You know, in his full glory in the book, because he's pointing the fingers at Kyle, saying Kyle's the one who's responsible for this. So I think it's a way of basically dividing and conquering and trying to pull people together to rally around him as he's trying to figure out how the hell I'm going to solve this problem before, of course, Kyle gives him an easy way to potentially solve this problem because of his ring.
Yeah, I was just looking over the Fatal Five scenes, because thinking like maybe they... I don't know, but like when they're talking to Parallax after seeing Kyle, they're actually like, hey, you know, maybe that guy can help. Maybe he can. He's got this ring that kind of reminds us of you or something. Maybe he can help fix the world. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, gotcha. So I just figured we should talk about why we like it. Obviously speaking for myself, I will talk about art and everything later on. But I think it kind of goes without saying, the flashback that you get just in terms of having these creators on a book as long as this in terms of page count was fun. I also think, too, that, and it's a question I asked Ron, because I was asking him, like, you know, are you not only trying to mimic the tone of Zero Hour, but also maybe... And I phrased it a different way, but like, are you trying? Because Zero Hour was a fucking mess of an event. A lot of people love the tie-ins more than the actual event, the actual pages of the main series. Some people got a little bit lost about what was happening and why. There wasn't a whole lot of coherence to some of what was going on in that book. So like, in a way, when you're trying to flash back to an event like Zero Hour for a 30th anniversary, and you're writing it, you're chosen as part of the writing or art team, where you're not only trying to capture the tone of the 90s, are you also maybe trying to recapture in a meta way some of the chaos and incoherent pieces of Zero Hour to sort of match its chaos, if you were to put the two stories together and read them at a clip. But coming to think about that, like, yeah, there's a little bit of chaos in this, but not nearly as much as the OG Zero Hour. I feel like, you know, we have maybe just one or two extra characters than we really needed, which helps kind of fill the page. I think maybe a couple of places here and there, we maybe spent too long in one and not enough into the other, but maybe that's just personal preference. But at the end of the day, I can make sense of this story. It has a, whether it's fatalistic or whatever the word was that you used, Dan, that's one thing, but there's a very clear kind of beginning, middle, end here. I'm not particularly lost about what's happening. Maybe some of like the reasoning behind certain things, the motives maybe for some of these characters may be strange to me. And you were talking, Dan, a bit about, you know, the whole superheroes got to fight upon meeting each other thing. That's actually something Mark and I spoke of, and I was like, we can ask him about that, but I dismissed that question for myself as not asking it, because I knew the answer was either, hey, that's a trope for a reason, and we have to see it every time we have a comic book where heroes who don't know each other meet, is either the meta answer, or the real answer is, by the time Kyle gets sucked into this story, the world is already dying and they have no idea who he is. And the first time one of them encounters him, he's standing at the feet of their dead friend. So, like, you know, of course they got to fight. So I was able to dismiss that pretty quickly, too. So, like, I'm not saying there are no reasons to criticize this story. I just feel like because it's a Zero Hour 30th anniversary, I'm more comparing it to Zero Hour than I am just like a general story or whatever, or even comparing it, because it's supposed to take place in our current continuity of the Green Lantern books we're currently getting, in terms of taking place before Green Lantern 8. I'm not really even judging it in terms of modern timelines. I'm judging it by the story that it's an anniversary of. And honestly, if you were to throw the anniversary special in a stack of the Zero Hour main series, all the tie-ins and so on and so forth, and I read every Zero Hour story, whether it's tie-ins, main story, epilogue in Green Lantern Zero, whatever, anything we've gotten even since that event that harkens back to Zero Hour, because I think there's a couple of comics out there that like flash back to Zero Hour from like the early 2000s or mid 2000s as well. Anything that ever involved Zero Hour, we put it in a stack and I read them all, and I'm just splitting on like, didn't like. This goes in the like pile.
Hey, I think overall, I mean, based on the event that it's going back to, is referencing back to, I think, much like it, there are some aspects of this that are uneven and kind of like maybe don't flow well, and we'll get into that. Spoiler alert, that has a lot to do with the art. But for me, I think this achieved pretty much, I liked it. I didn't love it. I enjoyed it. It met my base expectations for it. So I think that's important. I think I would have liked to have gotten more Parallax in it, because, you know, but. And maybe less of other characters that really, you know why they're in the book, because Dan Jurgens kind of wants them in the book pretty much, I think. But I don't know if they really belong, quote unquote, in the book, or they make as much sense, arguably. But it met basically my basic criteria here. First of all, on what it didn't do, like you said, it didn't give us this is a fear entity driven Parallax where it's just blatantly obvious. And he's either not looking like Parallax for very long, or he's not acting like Parallax, like we know him to as he was. So that didn't. So I met that criteria. It also feels natural as far as it feels like an extension of Zero Hour, especially once finally Dan Jurgens gets in the book and starts drawing it, which I think happens way too late. But as the Ron said in the interview, this thing came together so quickly, and they needed to get like everything, the script and everything, I think, done by April, so this book could possibly get published in August, which is when DC wanted it, it made sense. Some of these artistic decisions could have also been heavily drawn, no pun intended, on that fact. But it also ended with, I think, a blatantly obvious way to pick up the story, and maybe some others too. So I thought that was cool. I didn't want it to just be a literal one shot where it's like, okay, that was nice, or like a flashback to this. But like, kind of like what Dan said, if this was had just been a parallax, like an Emerald Knight time skipping, and we know he's not going to be back again, in, you know, anytime soon, because he's meant to go back to the events of Zero Hour and meet his fate. I don't know if it would have been as effective, but I kind of like that it was its own animal on that level.
I'm glad you guys like it. Nah, I mean, it's just, and I want to be clear, like I like a lot of Ron Mars's writing. If I wouldn't have spent most, like, so much of my life on comics if it wasn't for the stories that he wrote, you know? It's just like, I don't know. This one just didn't rub me the right way. Its shortcomings outweighed the good parts for me.
I can understand that. So should we wade into the art?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Say whatever. Yes.
Well, I mean, first, the one story thing left to bring up is that they just had to continue the Grand Zero Hour tradition of killing the JSA, huh? We got like a page dedicated to like, oh, and by the way, the JSA is totally dead. Don't even worry about it.
That is true. Well,
I mean, you could have just assumed, you know, like we didn't check in on every hero that we thought could be alive, but they're like, nope, JSA dead. Don't worry. It really freaked them out too along the way.
Well, that's probably why they gave so much. Arguably why you could justify giving Obsidian so much of a role in this, I suppose, too, because of that. But following that tradition, I also like that it was very Zero Hour like, where you ended up having different teams of heroes squaring off against each other and people changing teams. And because you actually had that the moment we almost had in real Zero Hour, where Guy Gardner is actually on Parallax's side, since it's not extant, to get in the way before he realizes, oh, damn, I can't support this guy, which is really not Guy like. Because it's like, well, my universe is gonna die now. But it was kind of fun when he was punching Kyle. And hey, man, if one of them's got to go, it's not going to be mine.
But yeah, one rather benign art thing I wanted to bring up, because this actually isn't the first issue that's done it. The last few times that Darryl Banks has come back to draw Kyle for something, you know, he's given him the 90s chess emblem, which is the correct answer. But lately he's been putting it in a circle, and I don't know why.
Oh, as opposed to just like leaving the circle there, and it's the implied circle.
Like it back in the 90s, there was never a circle around it. But now, right,
the way the black molded around the top and the bottom implied a circle that was never there.
Yeah. Like, look at the page where it's the first page with Kyle on it. And it's like, there's just a circle around it. And it's like a totally innocuous detail that means nothing. It's just like a weird thing to add when you're making this big of an attempt to go retro with it. But that's just the thing that jumps out at me.
I would have thought the thing that would jump out would be in the Kelly Jones part, where half of the time we see Kyle's ring, it's on his right pointer finger. Did you guys notice that?
I didn't, but I'm gonna go look. I'm gonna go look now.
Well,
if you can make anything out of that Kelly Jones art, that's good for you. It's like it's like a blind chimpanzee was drawing that.
I Kelly Jones's art is not for everybody. I think that's a well-established fact, and just in the comics community in general, he's one of those people who I think is better attributed to when things get weird or supernatural or whatever. I'm thinking of, being a Dead Man fan, there was a very notable run with some Dead Man stories illustrated by Kelly Jones. He looked very skeletal and creepy and decaying at some points and things like that. I just as an illustration of Kelly Jones you know, being able to shine when things get weird. Look at all of the Kelly Jones art that is throughout this section, and then look at the amount of work that goes into the design for this bat wheelchair unicycle thing.
Yeah.
Which is really crazy. So.
Yeah, it's a strange, like
Kyle doesn't even have five fingers in half of these drawings.
Yeah.
In that section of the book. I'm just looking. He's got like four fingers.
It's a much more impressionistic art style. Like it's Batgirl has a completely different character model in every single panel that she's in. And it's I don't even know how to describe it. It throws away realism and accuracy in favor of like what can sell the vibe of the moment the best. And I think that's a harder sell in like, especially in like DC and Marvel superhero comics, when there's almost an implied expectation that it's going to look as realistic as possible.
I think
Kelly Jones is one of those artists where you either like him or you don't, and there's a lot of people who just don't vibe with him. And I'm not saying that he doesn't have some issues in terms of like actual execution of art, like in missing fingers and all that other stuff. I'm not saying that whatsoever. I'm just saying that his overall vibe is one that is very polarizing for people.
And I think the problem is, now again, the way this has kind of been set up, that you can justify there being a lot of artists in this book for multiple reasons, even beyond the annoying DC habit of, hey, we have an 80-page issue. Even if it's an anthology, that's another story, because you're going to have multiple writers. You're going to have multiple artists, because they're telling different stories that are all under one umbrella, some connective tissue, which is uniting all these stories, but they're their own thing. That's something different. But when you have one book that's telling one story, whenever you have 3,000 artists in it, it always hurts the book because it's just uneven. So you have this style of art, which objectively speaking is by far the worst art in the book, is the Kelly Jones stuff. Especially when you sandwich it right after Daryl. And it's like, it does not belong in. And again, part of it is because they're trying to bring in the artists who were heavily in the 90s, and we get that. But still, it does not work with what this story is about in the zero hour proper and everything. You can make a strong case if they had more time that maybe there probably should have been two artists on this book. It should have been Daryl and it should have been Dan, and that should have been it. But the Pelletier art was good. It was fine. The Grumman art was good. But the reality of the unevenness of this art takes away from this book. It's unfortunate that it does, and I understand, because they're writing 80 pages together, that that's probably part of the reason why Dan Jurgens didn't draw that much of this book, and it was really, really late in the game. And that's cool when he comes in, because it absolutely feels like Zero Hour when he's drawing Wave Rider flowing through this and showing up. It absolutely feels at the critical moment of the book like Zero Hour. But I think the unevenness of the art to begin with is, I don't think it's ever good in these big specials. I think it's just, you understand if you're in a crunch for time, I can understand it to a certain extent, but it's uneven. Just like it would be uneven if you had six different writers, which is usually how you can tell when a movie's bad. When you see six different people giving screenplay credit, it usually means it's not good. So
if anything, the fact that this story takes place in a reality that's breaking down means that there could have been a narrative explanation for the shifting art styles. Or even if it's something as simple as okay, Gotham looks like Kelly Jones art and Metropolis looks like Paul Pelletier art, because that's just how Hal put it together and he wasn't as good at it as he thought he was. Or maybe it's a part of the deterioration. Who knows? Like make the characters like aware of the differences and apply those differences more strategically, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if it was based on story reasons, you can get away with it. Just like if you're doing, I kind of said this when I picked up my comics and was talking to the guy at the comic shop, the owner, that like if they had done something like that in the John Stewart book, where everything that's taking place inside the Dark Star of the Fen was drawn by somebody else, and then everything outside in Metropolis dealing with his mom and dealing with Star Shroud was drawn by somebody else, you could get away with it there because narratively, storytelling-wise, you're in two different worlds, so they could look completely different. So you were correct. That could make sense.
That's exactly what they did in the Thorn run.
Yeah.
But complimented the Thorn run.
Inadvertently.
Do you guys think Hal Jordan exists in this story?
I think he exists in the hearts and minds of every child.
No. So I'm looking at the page that says, "Welcome to Coast City. This thing handles like a dream. My compliments to the boys in Ferris Design. Enough punching holes in clouds for one day. Heading back to the airfield now. Have those beers on ice when I get there, okay?" Do you think Hal gave himself his own little happy life where he was never a GL? Like, he, in this universe that he created himself, a secondary himself that's just test pilot at Ferris, lives happily with Carol?
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only reason I can think of to put that bit in there.
Yeah, plus when you think about it, it balances out the, or it's a complement perfectly to where basically, you know, where's Hal's throne? And it's like in a plane, pretty much. Yeah. He's just floating there, and, you know, in that plane where that's where he's sitting in his pseudo throne. So in a way, it makes perfect sense that, yeah. Yeah, I did notice that too. I kind of forgot about it when we were talking to Ron, but I did notice that because first I thought that was going to be a direct tie-in, but you could tell it's not based on the way the dialogue balloons are.
I think too, it's a reference because in the Green Lantern novel that I keep trying to get us to cover, the one written by Denny O'Neill that focuses on Kyle, there's a point where Kyle kind of gets put in jail by the Guardians, and that's where Kyle Rayner meets Hal Jordan for the first time, because he's in this kind of idyllic world where like anything you like, let's say you need breakfast, you're like, you know what, bacon, a couple of eggs over easy, fresh squeeze orange juice, and you walk out into your living room and bam, there it is. Like it's just a world where all your needs are met, but you can't interfere with anything. When they finally realize that they're in jail and they try to escape, Hal orders a Ferris and he gives it, he calls it a cloud puncher, which is not so the enough punching holes in clouds for one day. It made me think of that.
Huh.
Yeah. I don't know where that's a reference in the actual comic series to an actual plane that Ferris built, but I'll definitely have to find it someday. But anyways, I brought it up because we talked about Daryl. We talked about Kelly Jones. So Tom Grumman and Norm Ratman, I thought a lot of that was pretty good. It actually, because we're focusing so much on Legion in the first two pages, it reminds me a lot of Legion. I think there's a couple of spots where, especially when Azrael shows up, that Kyle's face mask, his crab mask, looks strange. But I think it's okay. It's Jerry Ordway that starts to bother me again, especially when we get to like Donna's face and some of Kyle's facial design and things like that. It looks really weird, but then all of a sudden Jerry Ordway's art starts to really shine on those five pages for Obsidian.
Oh yeah. Oh yes. Yeah.
So, that's okay. But then we get Paul Pelletier and Norm Ratman. I think that shines, pretty well. The double page splash of Kyle versus Parallax is interesting. I don't really have any problems with any of that particular art, which does last for a good while. And then Howard Porter, I don't know exactly how to feel. it's great in some spots and then strange in others, chaotic, which I guess makes sense for Howard Porter to be chosen for this particular section, because that's when the Oblivion Wave is showing up and all the other characters are finally there on the page and pitted against each other, massive fights going on while the world is being destroyed all around him. So the chaos of his art.
Yeah, I didn't like.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think that. I honestly think that is the second. To me, that's the second worst stretch of the book when it comes to art after Kelly Jones. There are some parts that were. I mean, first of all, Wave Rider looked horrible when he draws Wave Rider, but there are some of those little panels that look okay, and he draws some characters well. His parallax is really bad, especially that one panel on the right when he had his arms raised like with his two hands, his fists are raised. All I have to do is take the destructive force that was about to annihilate everything that we hold dear. That panel, horrible. I think that's the problem. The majority of the art is good and it's fine. It's just the fact that the stuff that doesn't work, or the stuff that it's because, and again, part of it's just the contrasting styles, but it's just so dramatic that it just kind of it just really takes you out. And it's
I will say, and if Daryl's listening because he's a friend of the show, whatever, loved his art, great. I will say Daryl's art in this is my second favorite. I think I found Daryl. I don't know. There's no mention of any inkers, and usually that means they ink themselves. But so maybe Daryl inked himself. It felt a little ink heavy for Daryl stuff. So my favorite art in terms of I like the most panels per capita and so on and so forth is actually Dan Jurgens and Brett Breeding. That's my favorite art of all of them. I thought a lot of the faces were really well done. The poses, the action, so on and so forth. I thought it was really well. I have one or two problems with like maybe Guy Gardner's face in one panel or two, one of Parallax's faces, and then just the Parallax design of the entity at the very end. But beyond that, the Brett Breeding why did I forget his name? Dan Jurgens. The Brett Breeding and Dan Jurgens art is my favorite.
Daryl and Dan for me. It's pretty strong. And yes, would I prefer them again to draw the original version of the Parallax entity more like the dragon like Parallax as opposed to just the chunky like bug like salamander kind of one? Yeah, but if you kind of accept that for the most part, this is what you're gonna get now. But
yeah, I really like Daryl's artwork. Even with that weird circle. And I didn't realize how much I miss seeing Paul Pelletier draw Kyle. Like that, he's one that doesn't really come back to it very often. So it was really nice to see here. And I think it's Jerry Ordway. Like the page with Obsidian standing there and you see all these vignettes of other characters in his cape.
Yeah.
That's like...
like the Fourth World and Lobo and that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Martian Manhunter's there. Yeah. Like... not only is it cool to check in on so many other characters in a really economical way, it's just like it's such a good splash page. That's probably one of my favorite pages in the book.
I like all of the pages from the moment Obsidian comes out of the gravestone until that cape panel page. I would if I could afford them, I'd buy these pages.
Oh
yeah.
Although I think my favorite piece of art in the whole book is the Starman pinup in the back by Tony Harris. Yes!
I'm so glad you said something because I want that as a cover. I am not a Starman guy at all, but I love that pinup.
Listen, you should look up the covers to the 6-volume omnibus set of that series because this is done in the style of those covers. It's so good.
Yeah, there was another pinup I like more, or not more, but almost as much as I do like the Trinity, the female Trinity by Nicholas Scott and at Quark. Yeah,
that is cool.
Yeah,
it is funny seeing Batgirl drawn like Batgirl as opposed to the Kelly Jones in the book. True. I was like, you wouldn't even think that was literally in the same universe. It's like, did one eat the other one?
Yeah, I wanted to post about the Tony Harris pinup for Starman on social media when DC gave us a copy of this. But then I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot. We're not allowed to post about this until a certain time. But all in all, I enjoyed it. I'm glad to have it. You know, I'm glad I got to read it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have expected them to do this at all. Like, I don't really usually think about Zero Hour as one of the like the oft thought about and revisited events, you know? So like the fact that they did this project is really kind of cool.
Well, Ron talked about that a little bit too, because of how successful the Superman, their, you know, the Death and Return of Superman specials and tie-ins were when they did that like last year. So he and Dan were talking because it's the 30 because this year was the 30th anniversary, not just the Zero Hour, but Emerald Twilight. So we almost got a special of each, which I kind of would have think I probably would have preferred that if we had gotten one Zero Hour special and one Emerald Twilight special. I think I probably would have preferred that better, but no matter what, I think this was good. And they had some really good covers for this. I usually don't buy multiple covers, but I bought
lots of good covers.
Yeah, I bought three different covers on this issue.
Only three? You call yourself a fan?
I didn't get the Kyle one. That's the one I didn't get.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dan, to help us complete, as you said, complete the Zero Hour Trinity there. If people are looking forward to more of your coverage and the stuff that you have to offer, what do they have to look forward to there?
Well, I figure I'll go over and start making Zero Hour videos because apparently there's a lot to talk about. But no, seriously, there is a lot happening on the Mosaic Comics YouTube channel over the next 2 months. By the end of September, I will be done with my coverage of Green Lantern War Journal, done with my coverage of the Alan Scott miniseries, and just about caught up with the Jeremy Adams Green Lantern book. Everything before the start of the Absolute Power tie-ins. So that's 8 videos coming out in September. And then in October, I'm devoting the entire month to diving deep into the story of Blackest Night. I have a series of 7 videos coming out across the month, starting on October 1st and ending on Halloween Day, that cover Blackest Night 0 through 8, Green Lantern 43 through 52, Green Lantern Core 39 through 47, Blackest Night Superman 1 to 3, Blackest Night JSA 1 to 3, Blackest Night Titans 1 to 3, Blackest Night Wonder Woman 1 to 3, and the Atom and Hawkman 46.
I love that Resurrected title, by the way.
Oh, yeah. It's the best one. I mean, there a lot of them are good, but this is the one that ties directly into the storylines we've been following through the event. And it's the one that doesn't, like, require you to know the context of the series that it's picking up from. So all of these videos for September and October are finished and ready to go. And I think the Blackest Night especially is some of my best work on the channel so far. It's certainly the biggest project I've ever taken on. So if you're in the mood for a metric ton of Green Lantern content, go subscribe to Mosaic Comics on YouTube because the next 2 months are going to be crazy.
I've been actually meaning to do a Blackest Night reread. I didn't even do it when we did it. We did it for JL May a couple years ago when Lantern Cast was in charge of it. But now I can just put it off until October and let you do it for me.
Hooray! You can have fun navigating the reading order that I made up for the project, which I'm sure will make people mad. But you know what? You know what? It makes each video work as its own bespoke thing while also feeding into a larger narrative. And some of this shit, so much stuff happens at the exact same time. And I need to make it make sense. So, you know what? Trust me. Watch the videos. Subscribe. Tell your friends.
And if people want to reach out to us, Mark, how do they do so?
LanternCast@gmail.com. The website is LanternCast.com. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, hashtag GLCast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean. Wherever you listen to us, please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail or a text, 708 Lantern. LanternCast Vids is also our YouTube channel. We have some stuff there, and more stuff will be coming out soon there. So 708 Lantern for the text or voicemail, and let us know what you think.
All right, guys. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.